Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
This episode is brought to you by Smart Food Popcorn. Some decisions aren't the best, like skipping ahead in your favorite podcast. Think of all the banter you'll miss, the lore in the making. Luckily, Smart Food Popcorn is a no-brainer. Deliciously tasty and available in a variety of fun flavors. It's a smart decision every time. Smart Food. Add smart. To learn more, visit smartfood.com.
Hey, everybody. This is Maria Muldaur, and you're listening to Rock and Roll Archaeology on Pantheon Podcast.
Pantheon Podcasts presents Deeper Digs in Rock, part of the Rock and Roll Archaeology Project. Music. Culture. Technology. And rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Can anybody find me somebody to love? Oh, that's you diggers. Christian Swain here, the rock and roll archaeologist, coming to you from the San Francisco headquarters of Pantheon Podcasts once again. Shout out time, and really just the shout out goes to all of you who tune in every week and listen to all our shows. We are growing and growing so quickly. I don't know what to say. Tell a friend, but you're apparently doing that. So we appreciate all of the help that you guys do, whether it is just tuning in and listening every week, listening to some of the newer shows, sharing, telling a friend, leaving reviews, and of course help on Patreon. If you're not a Patreon patron, please check out our Patreon page to just help out with the overhead costs and getting the network in solid working order. You can go to patreon.com/rockandrollpodcast, singular. Okay, plenty of news, but no new announcements, except to say we had an incredible week, and hope to be able to share some of this in the next few weeks. Just a lot going on. It's great. It's going to be fantastic. You guys are going to love it. So just keep tuning in and grow with us. Be a part of it. It's the community of diggers. It is. It's all about you guys. And please send us a line. Tell us what you think. Give us suggestions. We may not get to it right away, but we definitely keep a file on that and look back on it from time to time. Okay. All right. This week's show is again sponsored by CBD Vermont, which partners with organic farms in Vermont to produce organically grown hemp used in full spectrum extracts. Available for sale at cbdvermont.com. Use the code DDIR to get 15% off all of their products. CBD Vermont guarantees their farms a price per plant and provide cultivation support throughout the growing season. Now, there are a lot of CBD products out there, so how do you know what you're getting? Well, CBD Vermont tests all of its extracts to ensure you are getting the right amount of CBD and other cannabinoids and no unwanted toxins. I mean, because who wants that, right? Plus, each batch is traced to the Vermont farm where it was grown and the hemp cultivar that was extracted. They've recently launched an online store where you can buy Vermont-made CBD products, including oils, capsules, edibles, and topicals. I know, I just ordered some more topicals that have been fully vetted by the staff at CBD Vermont. I am telling you, it works. It worked for me, and it should work for you as well. Go to cbdvermont.com and please use the code DDIR at checkout to get 15% off your purchase. Okay, that is it for this week. Let's get to our guest.
She got girls.
Today, we go back to school to continue our higher education in rock and roll with Associate Professor Evelyn McDonald. Currently, she is on staff at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, where she is the Director of Journalism for the school. She has written several books, most notably Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways, Army of She, Icelandic, Iconoclastic, Irrepressible Bjork, and most recently Women Who Rock, Bessie to Beyonce, Girl Groups to Riot Girl, all of which we will get into today. Professor McDonald was born a California girl, but grew up in Beloit, Wisconsin, a smallish town in between Milwaukee and Chicago. Becoming a teenager and having plenty of music around the house, she fell in love with the outsiders of the day. You know, people like Iggy Pop, Patti Smith, and bands like New Order and the Dead Kennedys. She was accepted into Brown University, which is kind of in between New York and Boston, so had touring bands coming through all the time. Her exposure grew exponentially, and she began writing articles for the local Providence Rags that then grew into pieces for Rolling Stone, Spin, Ms., The New York Times, and Billboard. In 1996, she was named music editor of the Village Voice. In 1995, her first book, Rock She Wrote, Women Write About Rock, Pop, and Rap, was released. And from 2001 through 2007, she was the pop culture writer for the Miami Herald, where in the end, she realized the publishing industry's disruption maybe wasn't where her best skills were suited. So she finally headed back to California, where she was awarded an Annenberg Fellowship to study in specialized journalism from USC. Getting her master's led to her current position at LMU as associate professor, where she teaches journalism and specializing in music, politics, and gender. So let's get down to it. I give you Professor Evelyn McDonald.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Welcome to Deeper Digs in Rock, Evelyn McDonald. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me to be on your show.
Oh, we're really glad to have you. So you are an associate professor of journalism at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, and your interest of study is the conflagration of music, gender, and politics. So first question is, tell us what that means for you.
Well, this is... stems really from lifelong interest in music. Ever since I was a kid, I loved to listen to my parents' records and dance to them and try to sing along. Eventually, I realized that...
The trying part was where it would stay.
Yes, exactly. This was not my talent, nor actually... was the dancing part of it.
Rhythmically challenged, are you?
Well, you know, I can't, if someone tells me to put my foot somewhere, I will put it the opposite direction. I cannot be choreographed.
Okay.
The choreography, well. But I did always love to write, along with loving music. I liked to write. So I became a music journalist. I kind of just put, you know, one and one together and got two. And became a rock critic, music journalist, what have you, and pursued that career to this day, which is now a few decades since I started professionally.
Yeah.
In the process of that career, and, you know, I've written and edited for all kinds of publications.
Yeah, I believe the Rolling Stone magazine. I've seen some of your articles there. Village Voice, Los Angeles Times. There's many others.
I was the pop music critic at the Miami Herald for 8 years. I found my way to academia somewhat late in my life and career, or later in, you know, sort of a mid-career change, shall we say.
Oh, so you went from critic to academic.
Yeah, I like to say I went from being a media-based scholar to a university-based scholar.
Huh, which pays better?
It depends.
I think part of it maybe is that you saw the disruption in the journalism trade.
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And yeah, you know,
and you said, uh-oh, this is not good.
Right. I saw the disruption in media. And also I was getting older and I had a child and wasn't necessarily committed to a life of being in the clubs 5 nights a week, which I think is pretty important to being a full-time music critic.
Right. Right. You have to be out to see the live music. Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't completely jump the track. I see it as a continuum. I just, you know, I used to edit and copy edit in addition to write. Now I teach and administrate. I actually direct our journalism program at LMU. And, you know, the other thing is that I've always been really interested in writing books. And I've, you know, been fortunate to be able to do that since pretty early in my career.
I think you now have 7 under your belt, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and that also is a nice fit with academia. Mm-hmm. But, you know, throughout this whole time, I've also been very interested in the role that women have played in music and the way in which gender can inform music and the way that gender can also be an obstacle in careers, which I unfortunately occasionally encountered in my own career. So that kind of brought it all together, you know, but again, you know, even as a kid, my parents were feminists and they raised me to, you know, believe that I could do whatever my brother did and to have as big of a record collection as he did.
Very nice. So where did you grow up? Because I know you've done most of your work on the coasts, whether New York or Los Angeles. But I believe you're from the Midwest, right?
Yeah, I actually I grew up in Wisconsin in a town called Beloit, which is a smallish college town on the Illinois border. So mm-hmm. I was actually born in L.A., though. So I've done a full circle back to L.A. It took 4 decades to do it. And I did, you know, cover the coasts and you know, Miami, the South, to come back here.
You had to work hard for it to become a Californian again.
I did. I did. It took me a while. I'm glad to be back, though.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that a lot from people in between the coasts and or just even outside of California. I mean, it is kind of paradise here. I'm in San Francisco, if you didn't know. So I get it. I totally understand. So, OK, so music, gender, politics, that is your study of choice. Now, we believe the rock and roll era is mostly a story of America in the latter half of the 20th century. And for women, it's an arc from outsider, not normally allowed to engage to more and more involvement. Do you agree with that?
Well, yes and no. Although I would argue that a lot of the foundation is built on women, and that some of the very early strains of rock and roll were laid by women, such as Sister Rosetta Tharpe. I mean, I think yeah.
Big Mama Thornton, people like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Lady Bo Diddley. You know, Wanda Jackson,
yeah,
Patsy Cline, even, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that a lot of the story of rock and roll is that women have always been there. They just haven't always been acknowledged sufficiently, or they've been
not on equal par.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or they've been considered like anomalies. And sometimes even just because they're women, they're put into, they're called pop, even though there's not necessarily any difference between their music and what the men are doing.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned Wanda Jackson. I kind of listened to her and, you know, she definitely, without a doubt, sounds like a rock and roll singer.
Absolutely.
You know, and one of the first, and this is in the 1950s. I mean, she is a contemporary of Elvis and Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and that whole first iteration of, you know, what is considered the genesis of rock and roll, right?
Right, but you never see her, you know.
Included in that list that I just mentioned.
Absolutely. No, she's not. It just got posted online last week. There is a woman who is studying women in rock and roll in the 1950s as a scholar, and she's unearthed a number of figures that have been overlooked. And, you know, and part of it is like people's careers are overlooked or they're marginalized or they're, you know, categorized as pop and not made part of the rock and roll canon. And then of course, you know, there's just that women's careers weren't supported at the same time. And, you know, they didn't have all the opportunities that Chuck Berry or Jerry Lee Lewis had.
There also wasn't the expectation in society. I mean, and as you mentioned, you know, just due to gender, if there are children involved, then, you know, unfortunately, certainly back in the day, maybe less so today, you know, the expectation was, well, you know, the woman's job was now in the home, right?
Right, right. And certainly the 50s, of course, was a period of putting women back in the home and, you know, the return of the housewife figure.
Yeah.
After Rosie the Riveter.
Right, right, right. We need to stick this genie back in the bottle.
Right, right. Right.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that's also part of what happened in that era.
I think there's also a racial component as well. Some of the precursors that we mentioned.
Big Mama, Sister Rosetta.
Big Mama and Sister Rosetta, exactly.
Right.
Were black artists.
Right.
You know, were not given the same accolades as white artists were. I think it's not really until Janis Joplin arrives that do, you know, women rockers finally get some sort of real media recognition. I think she ends up on the cover of Time magazine and others that really says that moment may have arrived at that time, right?
Right, right. And the girl groups are case in point
The
way in which women get, oh, that wasn't rock and roll. How was that not rock and roll? I don't know, because they were women and because a lot of them were black. So it was race music or it was pop. You know, I really think that, and, you know, if you're writing the history of rock and roll now, this idea that like it went into some hibernation between Elvis and the Beatles, that's just not true. That's just a white male version of rock and roll history. And
well, from a white male perspective, it did go into hibernation between Elvis, you know, after Chuck Berry is sent to jail, Buddy Holly dies, Elvis is in the army, Little Richard is in the priesthood, you know, for a time. But the charts are filled with a lot of Motown, and a lot of those Motown groups are girl groups.
Right, right.
Yeah. And they are ruling the pop charts at that time. And so, you know, as opposed to diluted white male versions of old rock and roll songs.
Right, right. But then, like, I mean, when, you know, men take over the charts again in the 60s with the British invasion, those guys just wanted to be, you know, Smokey Robinson and Darlene Love, you know?
Yeah, they took all those influences and included them in their version of rock and roll.
Right.
Even though it wasn't, you know, the women that were actually performing at that point, there still was this expectation of, oh, well, men should do it better. And I guess it's not until we get into the later 60s that you see the rise of, well, Aretha Franklin. I think anyone would agree, once she gets into Atlantic, begins to, you know, solidify herself as, you know, a real rock star. I don't think there's any other way to put it than that. And then, you know, as we discussed just a minute ago, Janis Joplin really just kind of breaks the lid open, and things really start to change here at the latter end of the 60s.
Right, right. Though I would, you know, still argue for the importance of the Supremes or, you know, the Ronettes.
Yeah, who were ruling the charts. Yeah.
Right, as having, you know, paved the way for Aretha and Janis and Grace Slick and
But it is an evolution from, you know, especially culturally, and the allowance of women to gain greater and greater fame and be recognized for their contributions as we move closer to our current situation, where now, let's face it, women rule all the pop charts.
Yes. Yeah. And of course, there's, you know, an important shift from the girl groups to Janice and Aretha, in that Janice and Aretha were able to be themselves, and you know, they weren't
prepackaged.
They were, yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, and they, yeah,
in the assembly line, like you know, Motown is famous for.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So that's really important, and yes, women rule a lot of the charts. Though I have to say, when, you know, the year end, you know, top streaming artist lists come out, men still rule that. So,
really, even today,
mm-hmm,
when you have people like Beyonce and Taylor Swift, Katy Perry, Lady Gaga, you know, pretty much anything they put out there, you know, shoots to number one and stays there. It's still men who are ruling the year end list. Is that because most of those lists are written by men? Or compiled by men?
These are just pure numbers of streaming, of most streamed songs and artists. So it's purely the numbers. And I believe that Ariana Grande is the only exception to that. And I could even be like the top five, but I mean, top 10, but at least the top five artists of 2018. It was, I think Ariana was the only woman on it. So it's pure numbers. And there's been some work done around the algorithms of Spotify that indicate that they might skew toward male artists. So that could, you know, be part of it.
Really?
You know, also, you know, most of the artists that you mentioned didn't have a big album in 2018. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no Adele, there was no Beyonce, there was no, well, there was the Carters, there was Beyonce and Jay-Z together. But, you know, Beyonce hasn't had the kind of chart numerical success for a while that she had. I think, you know, the streaming is like young kids, and young kids are listening to
K-pop.
Well, they are listening to K-pop, but Drake. I think Drake was.
Yeah, Drake is. Yeah, was the big one. But, well, he did something different, I think, than a lot of artists. You know, there's still this focus on the album. And I don't think we live in that world anymore. No. I think we are back to the world of singles. And I think what Drake has done is, you know, just put out singles, which allows him to play the charts differently than other artists. I just think it's a question of economy and distribution and expectation when it comes to that.
Yeah. I mean, but of course, I mean, Beyonce's also, you know, I mean, I think Lemonade was just one of the greatest albums of all time. And then she, you know, took that to the nth level, mm-hmm, with the whole video. That, you know, wasn't just an album.
It was an entire media extravaganza.
Right, right. Right. But yeah, I'm very curious about that world of SoundCloud and Spotify, and how I am concerned that that's becoming gendered again in a way that's all too familiar, but disappointing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
And your study into it has been that the algorithms are skewed?
Well, there's a woman named Liz Pelly who's done some work on this, and I have not dug deeply into that, but yes, that is what she has found out. She writes for like Pitchfork and Billboard, and I mean, I am definitely not an expert on this.
Well, it is changing how people consume their music. There's no doubt about that. There is no going back to, you know, a tangible product or even the download anymore. It is all going to be streaming. That is the future of how people will digest their music.
Right. Right.
Then we have to just be vigilant and call out those egregious instances when they occur.
Yep. I will try to send you a link to some of her work. It's
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we now know you grew up in Wisconsin, and you at least had one brother who had a very large record collection.
Yes.
And you had your own. So tell us how music infected you and took over your life, which it has. I think there's no going back at this point. So who was the first artist that really spoke to you that you called your own?
Wow. You know, it's funny. It was actually Michael Jackson.
Really?
I know, which is so deep at this point in time, right? But it's always been.
you may want to revisit that.
It's very, it's intense. It's a very, many layered situation. It's really the Jackson 5.
Okay.
But it was Michael in particular.
Well, let's face it, he was a once in a generation talent. I'm of the opinion that we must separate the artist from, you know, and the art that is created from the life they led. I famously tell people my favorite painter of all time is Caravaggio, and he killed people with swords. So, you know, there you have it.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's also hard because, you know, at some point his music was dealing with and, you know, negating the accusations or trying to negate them. And at one point, you know, it all becomes so entwined. But during the age of the Jackson 5, he was still actually the victim, not the
right.
Either, right? Right.
Right. Yes, I believe you can hang your hat on that. Yes.
Yeah. And yes, certainly we can't just cancel that whole legacy, though we do have to come to terms with. And, you know, I think a lot of that is also coming to terms with our celebrity culture and what we'll let stars get away with.
I don't think it's just stars. I think it's just, you know, it's the age old problem of, you know, it's the golden rule. You know, he with gold makes the rules.
Right.
And I mean, I think we see that on display every day now. It's just returning back to, I don't know, you know, the divine right of kings.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And just deliver your child to the king.
And whatever you do with him is fine as long as we get some benefit from it. Patron of my poor existence.
Right, right. But I mean, but I was like a kid who was obsessed. I idolatized Michael Jackson. So I completely relate to that in a lot of ways. And you know, he was the same age as I was, so there was also not that, you know, weird element going on.
Yeah. And the Jackson had a cartoon series. Is that where it started?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I used to watch that cartoon series. It was so great.
Yeah. Same here. Yeah. And it was unusual for a set of black kids to, you know, literally infiltrate into the young minds of white kids.
Right. Right.
It was interesting, but they were so fun and normal, you know, in a way that it was presented in the same way that the monkeys were.
Right. And then it was funny because then it was actually going back to like the 1950s and, you know, the white appropriation of black pioneering. Then the Osmonds came and had.
Oh, yes. The exact same thing. Right.
Right.
Right. To compete against them. Yeah. For those who couldn't stomach those young black kids.
I mean, I was, you know, a white kid in a small Midwestern town. And honestly, I knew that the Jackson 5 were black, but it really didn't matter at all to me. And I also knew that the Osmonds were nowhere near as interesting and as good. And
oh, they were Pat Boone.
Oh, they're terrible. Just terrible. I mean, it did not speak well for white people that that was that.
That was the answer to the Jackson 5. It's kind of like Soviet culture going up against American freedoms, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I would choose that. I get you. But okay. So Michael Jackson was the first artist that you called your own.
Right. Right. And I had, you know, Jackson 5 greatest hits album. And, you know, then I listened to music a lot. I was into, you know, my mother was really into musical theater. So we would see a lot of shows, movies, whatever. So I was into that, particularly the rock operas like
Hair and Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
And, things like
yeah.
That. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then the Beatles were the next act that I really asked. Now, of course, the Beatles were broken up by then. This was the 70s. But I discovered them in retrospect. And
oh, we all did. Yeah.
Right.
I caught the very tail end of it. I remember a conversation of people saying, oh, my God, the Beatles have broken up. I don't remember much of them beforehand. I certainly don't remember February 9th, 1964. I was far too young for that. I remember Yellow Submarine was something that caught my attention. But I definitely remember them breaking up. So okay, from the Jacksons to the Beatles, I mean, there's a gold mine to be had there.
Right. Yeah, I just devoured the whole Beatles catalog slowly.
Did it start with the Blue and Red Greatest Hits?
Yes,
it
did.
Yeah, same here. Okay, I figured so. Right.
It started with those and then... Yeah. And then we slowly, my parents had the White Album. That was the only Beatles album they had, but they had the White Album.
Really interesting choice. You mentioned your mom was very big into musical theater. I would think maybe Sgt. Pepper or Magical Mystery Tour, perhaps. But the White Album was interesting. Maybe that was just the moment that that when they said, you know, we'll spend our money on this one.
It's a good question why that album. And, you know, both my parents were into music, not like super into music, but they were. You know, we definitely had a turntable in the living room, and that was a big part of what we did. So, you know, I became eventually sort of, John Lennon was the Beatle.
You chose Lennon over McCartney. Yeah,
I did.
I know where this is going now.
Yeah. And then he died.
Oh, you remember that December 8th, 1980.
Absolutely. I do. Yeah, it was very traumatic. And then it was really, I discovered punk rock. I mean, punk rock happened actually, basically. You know, punk happened and I discovered Patti Smith and The Clash. So that was the genre that
first really spoke to you.
Yeah.
That was your own. That you said, Mom, I'm cutting my hair, dyeing it, and I'm getting a bunch of safety pins.
Basically.
How did your parents take that?
The first and only punk rocker in Beloit, Wisconsin.
You were the one and only with your own fanzine, huh?
I did not have a fanzine at that age. Fanzine culture hadn't penetrated to
Beloit at that point.
At that point. But I did have a little ripped up t-shirt that I made and wore, and I did dye my hair purple for my graduation. So
now, why isn't that on your website?
Actually, it didn't come out very well. It turns out that my hair doesn't take dye very well was what I discovered from that, which was probably a relief for my parents.
All right. So punk rock is the way forward. And is that part of what makes you leave to go and find some good punk rock, leave Beloit and maybe go and look for it elsewhere?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I just, you know, wanted to get out of Beloit probably anyways. Not to put down Beloit, because I still actually have a lot of friends there and I really value that experience I had growing up in the Midwest, and I do not consider it the flyover. And I think, you know, our country suffers by the divisions and people not understanding different regions of the country. But, you know, it was a small town and there was only so many opportunities. And yeah, I left for college. You know, basically I went away for college. I went to college, but I really spent most of my time at clubs, seeing bands, because that was not something I could really do in Beloit.
There wasn't a lot of that going on there.
No, I mean, there were local bands and I did see them sometimes and concerts would come through, but I went to college in Providence, Rhode Island. And that was great because basically bands going to Boston and New York stopped in Providence. So pretty much everybody came through and you also got to see them in a smaller venue than in
Boston or New York, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, that's right. You went to Brown University, right?
Yeah.
And good Ivy League education.
I got my good Ivy League education. I got my
safety pedigree. Safety pins and dyed hair and all.
I mean, of course, I was not the only punk rocker in Brown or Providence, which was, you know,
found your people.
It was a relief to me, but I also didn't necessarily fit in there either, which is why I, you know, I never went to campus parties. I just went to go see bands, pretty much.
So what's the first band that you saw there that just lit your world on fire?
Well, actually, one of the bands that came to campus my first year was Gang of Four.
Oh, okay. All right. So early 80s.
Yeah. Well, I already knew Gang, you know, I was already a fan of theirs. So I was
a little more new wave than punkish, but yeah.
Well, Yeah. You know, but so smart. Like, God, I still love those songs and such great rhythm. It's so funny because I just in April was at a conference and I got to meet two of them. They were there. So, yeah, it's funny how things come around. I saw so many bands back there and I was.
I mean, going to Providence, I mean, it makes perfect sense that every band going from New York to especially the English bands going from New York to Boston would make a stop in the college town there.
Right. Right. And, you know, it was also, I mean, the other thing that was happening was, you know, was the birth of hip hop. So I also, you know, I went to one of the first Fresh Fest festivals and, you know, saw Curtis Blow and, you know, saw.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's so, very early. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was also happening at Brown. Actually, there was like a funk night every Thursday night. And that was the one campus thing I did go to, you know, at the campus pub and everybody would dance.
So you graduate and you move into rock journalism. And this is the late 80s, right?
Yep.
What was your first job?
Well, I actually started writing for a newspaper called The New Paper, which was an alternative weekly in Providence. I started writing for them while I was still in college a little bit. That was my first paid gig. And so I kept doing that after I graduated. And I basically hung out in Providence for 2 years because I had that regular outlet that I could write for and get clips and get experience, you know, interview people. And I also was working as a freelance copy editor at the Providence Journal. And then I was like, you know, working in a club, booking bands and working at a record store and just sort of living the life of a music obsessed person. Basically, a music obsessed
trying to make a career out of it.
Yeah.
How to get paid with your passion, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it wasn't like there was great opportunities to earn a lot of money, but there was opportunities to earn a little bit. And I didn't need a lot. You know, rents were low, it was Providence, and I didn't have aspirations of a highfalutin lifestyle. I was happy to wear thrift store clothes and, you know, drive a beautiful car for it to be, you know, because I loved the music.
Right. You live for the music, right?
Yeah. And I got to go to shows for free and I got free records. In the
yeah. Market. You had a media pass, right?
So my habit was taken care of.
Yeah. Right. Your habit. Yeah. 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 That's very nice. And when did you leave Providence and move to the big town?
After 2 years after I graduated from college. So it was like 88. I moved to New York and pretty immediately started freelancing for Billboard and The Village Voice and Rolling Stone and Cream and New York Newsday, Option.
So you started freelancing for these various larger outlets like Billboard. Were you writing for Rolling Stone at this point?
I started around then. I had actually, even when I was in college, I had gotten an assignment for Rolling Stone, but then couldn't get the interview.
Was that always the mecca for you?
Yes. That's always what, you know,
you aspired for is.
Absolutely. That was the major outlet for music criticism that as far as I knew or cared. I mean, you know, what I found out was that the Village Voice was actually really where music criticism was being defined and refined and became the outlet. But the Voice.
It was a more street level.
And a
little ahead of the public, whereas, you know, Rolling Stone is commenting on the heights of whatever is happening.
Right. And you couldn't get the Village Voice on most newsstands and you couldn't get it sent to your home. Right. I mean, it was a regional publication. Yeah. Although my brother did used to go to the library and read it in Beloit, Wisconsin.
So I'd make it out to there to check on Sis's bylines.
No. This was long before I was writing for it. I think to partly to follow their music coverage. He did know my brother. You know, I did have like the big brother who was ahead of me in all this.
You got the hand-me-downs until you started to make your own.
Yes, exactly. Right.
I getcha. So then I believe you went to Miami to be the music critic for the Miami Herald, right?
Yeah. In 2001, actually. So I spent a good dozen years in New York writing, editing, going to a lot of shows, having a great time. And then I got hired, you know, really for like a dream job to be a full-time music critic for a major newspaper.
Yeah.
A town that had a, you know, really unique
vibrant music scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Although I have to say the live music scene was not great in Miami. It was much more of a club culture there.
Yeah.
Which was interesting and exciting too. Though the older I got and the more children I had, that became harder.
To hit the club scenes all the time.
Yeah. And, you know,
And also the time you said in 2001. So that is at the beginning of the media disruption. I mean, I'm sure you didn't see it as you took the job, but it probably wasn't long afterwards that you began to notice things weren't going well.
Yeah, no. And actually, it was funny because I got offered the job. And then like 3 hours later, they called me back and said, "You're not going to believe this, but we just got hit with a hiring freeze. You can't actually hire you yet until freezes." So it actually took them a few months to actually hire me. It was pretty crazy.
So you really did make it under the wire then.
Yeah. Certainly the whole time I was at the Herald, there were layoffs and, you know, buyouts and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. But you made it there for 8 years.
I did.
And then is that when you decided to pack it in and go to academia?
Well, at first I left to edit a website, actually a social media company that was a competitor to Facebook and, you know, obviously lost that competition. Needless to say.
Really? Well, yes, there is a one and only Facebook now. But I take it it's not MySpace.
No. Okay. It was called Moli, MOLI, and they were, you know, saw the MySpace example and built on it, and, you know, it was literally around the same time as Facebook was coming out of Harvard.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, some of the new controls that Facebook is trying to put in terms of privacy controls and having different kinds of accounts, that was Moli's vision. So it's interesting that some of that's come back around. But Moli also had this weird idea of curated content for the social media users, which is kind of a Yahoo meets Facebook model. And I was in charge of that content. So, you know, I saw the writing on the cyberspace or whatever. And
very quickly. Now, is this your first job not directly associated with music?
Yeah.
Poor decision there, Evelyn.
Well, I do think that, I mean,
the muse only works one way. And,
yeah.
It sounds like she wasn't very happy with you.
Yeah, I lasted there only a couple of years. Well, and the company only lasted like a year after that. So, but I mean, you know, it was a good experience to be like, okay, I worked at a startup. Like, that was the thing that you did. And I actually will say that it helped me get my academic job, but I had some kind of experience in the digital world.
Really?
Absolutely.
So you leave there. Is that when you went back to grad school?
Yes. So it's like,
and that's what got you to California, because I know you went to USC.
Yeah. I got a fellowship. I got an Annenberg fellowship to study arts journalism at USC. Now, this is after I'd been practicing art journalism for 2 decades. But the program was actually set up for mid-career professionals to sort of retool, which is, you know, what I did.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it worked out great. It was a wonderful program. And I also started writing what became my book, Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways, as my master's thesis.
So let's talk about Queens of Noise, The Real Story of the Runaways. So why and how did you come to write the book?
I had been a fan of, you know, Joan Jett since I was in high school and had interviewed her a few times in my career, including once for Rolling Stone, and had kind of gotten to know her a little bit because I lived in New York and she lived in New York, and I would literally run into her at shows because she's way cool like that, right? She would go see like Bikini Kill or, you know, whoever in like a small club, and there would be Joan Jett. And had bandied the idea of, you know, writing a book about her with her, and realized that she was not ready for that. But I felt like the story of the Runaways was this incredibly rich story, kind of a, you know, microcosm parable of the possibilities and the perils of being a woman in rock and roll. Yeah. And at the time that I, you know, started working on that, it was not a very well-known story, you know, and then the Runaways movie came out while I was working on this. So,
oh, how did you take that?
Well, I was like, you know, I wish my timing had been a little different.
Damn it. Just been a couple of years earlier, they could have used this as the template for the movie, right?
Yeah. But
options and all of that. But
right. But I mean, in some ways, it, you know, it did create more of a market for my book in the sense that
is true.
I knew who the Runaways were. And, you know, when I was able to fill in a lot of gaps that were not presented in that film, although I very much like that film, and actually the director, Polaris Sigismondi, actually helped me in my research very early on. My thesis actually focused on Sandy West, who was the drummer for the Runaways, who was a very incredibly interesting person, but also a very tragic story. And that thesis was published as the cover of the LA Weekly the week that the movie came out. So in some ways, I got something out of that movie coming out. Or published my first piece of the book, which I think did create interest in the book as a whole. And, you know, and I think it did help me get a contract that people knew who the Runaways were, and also that.
Yeah, because it was in the zeitgeist, and that certainly helped. Right. And you had already begun the research and were deep into the telling of the tale. So what surprised you most about the Runaways? What was the biggest thing that you took away from the story?
I think that these were these actually very talented teenage girls who, you know, just loved rock and roll like so many of us did, and how that shouldn't have seemed unusual or problematic. You know, this is the 1970s, right? But the fact was that there hadn't been any really successful all-female bands where
self-contained, right?
Yeah, like, self-contained, played their own instruments.
Yeah, played their own instruments, wrote their own songs, mostly.
Right.
And there had been attempts before. Not too long ago, I interviewed the Ace of Cups out of the 1960s San Francisco scene. They were one, but they didn't get the record contract. There was Fanny in the early 70s.
Right.
While they got a little bit further, they also didn't get the recognition that they deserved.
Right. Absolutely. So, you know, yes. And there was Goldie and the Gingerbreads and, you know.
Yeah. Goldie and the Gingerbreads. Yeah. And yeah, it's not until the Runaways, which kind of is the first that begins to kick the door open, because after that, you know, you in the punk rock scene, you do have like the Slits and a lot of other female bands that start to bubble to the surface, right?
Right. And, you know, and not that the Runaways were hugely successful, but they did travel the world. They did
have a multi album deal.
Right.
You know, they had the record company behind them. Right. There was attempts to turn them into a big act. It was a serious endeavor.
Yeah, exactly. Albeit, you know, complicated by, you know, the way they were presented as jailbait and, you know, the crap that they had to deal with as like young women was really horrific. But, and of course, you know, Joan Jett went on to have a hugely successful career. So we also probably wouldn't be as interested in, and Lita Ford, right?
Yeah, they proved their worth by those two. And especially Joan, let's face it, she's a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee. She's a legend going on to such success.
Right.
Yeah. So the band's put together by Kim Fowley as kind of a theme to do this exact thing, right?
Yeah. You know, and you know, Kim Fowley, like, you know, such a complicated character.
We've already hit on one. Why not go for another?
God. I mean, he did have this vision. You know, he saw these young girls in the nightclubs and he said, why can't they be on stage? right?
Yeah.
There was certainly something exploitative about his idea, but I would say that he also wanted to give them a kind of power and agency. And for every, you know, horrible thing he did, he also, you know, saw the promise of Joan Jett and, you know, gave these girls a platform and gave them an independence and sexually assaulted at least one of them, a couple of them. So, you know, just that story just encapsulated everything great and horrific about rock and roll and women.
Yeah, they kind of are the linchpin before and after, right?
Right. Right. And well, and then, you know, and then punk does come along.
Yeah, they're not really punk. They're kind of arena rock type of.
Yeah, they were more like hard rock. I mean, they were pre-punk, you know, and Joan became very punk.
Yeah.
And even Lita, you know, thinks of punk as an influence on her, although she's much more of a metal person. I think that they saw in punk
freedom.
Yeah.
A way through.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and they did.
It was part of the punk aesthetic was that everybody, at least the early part of it was, you know, these were the most marginalized kids. Therefore, everybody's welcome.
Right. Right. And women included.
Yes, included.
And they did. You know, they hung out with the Sex Pistols and they did fire Kim Fowley. Like, that's the part of the story that tends to get forgotten, that they did try to overthrow him. You know, they did try to come out from under that influence.
Yeah, from under the thumb.
Yes.
That's what I might say. Yes.
Yeah. Well put.
Yeah, and they continue to garner certainly influence to aspiring young women rockers, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, yeah. Including the Riot Girl movement, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, there's probably a direct line from the Riot Girl movement to the Runaways, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. So the Runaways were definitely a huge influence on the Riot Girl movement. You know, Bratmobile covered Cherry Bomb. Joan Jett produced Bikini Kill, mm-hmm. You know, and I always think that Joan saw in Riot Girl the possibility of what could have happened for the Runaways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So they definitely deserve all the accolades that they are now achieving. I mean, it's not, you know, in some ways you can compare them to the Ramones. You know, everybody thinks of the Ramones of like, you know, oh, these huge punk stars that and they could barely get gigs back in the day.
Right.
It's not until afterwards does the mythology put their standing much higher than the reality of their existence.
Right, right. And the Ramones and the Runaways toured.
Rightly so. Don't get me wrong. Rightly so. But it's a shame that they did not get to enjoy the fruits of their labor at the time.
Right. Well, Deborah Harry once told me that she was, you know, more famous than she was successful.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah, well, you know, it's a lot of the compact when it comes to music. You know, let's face it, the music business is not exactly the most above board business to get into in the first place. And the trade off is, you know, fame for money. You know, you get the fame and the record guys get the money.
Right. Exactly.
You know, so I'd love to see that dynamic change. And I think we live in a world, given the advent of social media in a positive sense, streaming services. It's very easy to now, you know, be your own person or your own band and not necessarily need a record company. I mean, there's no need for distribution, which, you know, was the only way to go about it back in the day with a tangible product that was needed to be put on shelves. You don't have that anymore. You can, you know, find all of the marketing that you need that the other side that the record company did for you if you're savvy enough and can hire the right people to just do it yourself.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I'd love to see more of that than the need for a quote unquote record business, which, you know, has stomped on too many people to even begin to mention in this podcast.
Right. Right.
So another subject you took your pen to was the Icelandic superstar in Army of She, Icelandic iconoclastic, irrepressible Björk. Why her?
Oh, yeah. I just love Bjork's music. First of all, the album Homogenic made me a thorough convert, still one of my favorite albums of all times. And I interviewed her for that album. It's the first time I interviewed her. I actually went to Iceland, to Reykjavik.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
You got an Icelandic trip out of it.
I know. Those were the days. I enjoyed talking to her so much. And she had this reputation of being this sort of quirky, odd person, which, you know, she is. She's definitely not your run-of-the-mill human being. But she is also just very, very smart and innovative. And, she, you know, she's not quirky because quirks make it sound like there's just like odd tangents. Like she has real ideas that she's following and pursuing. So I just felt very compelled by her. And, you know, I actually like that she is really a post-rock artist. You know, she cut her teeth on punk rock also. But then she really came on her own in the digital age. And when she emerged as a solo artist out of the Sugar Cubes, she was, you know, flowing out of trip hop. And she's always been so musically experimental and, you know, not dependent on any genre. And then, you know, her visual sense, her videos. I really think that, I mean, I think she's a genius. I really do. And so much emotion and feeling in her music. So yeah, to this day, I think she's just an incredible artist.
So when does she get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah, that is a very good question, right?
I think that was a big question this year because Stevie Nicks is the first female artist to be inducted twice.
Yes.
Once with Fleetwood Mac and then for her solo work, which is what she was inducted for this year. The one and only. Seems kind of sexist to me.
Right. Well, you know, I wrote a big story about this. And I don't know if you saw that for Long Reads called The Manhandling of Musical History. And I crunched the numbers and out of the, I forget the exact number, over 700 members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, people who've been inducted, fewer than 8% are women.
Fewer than 8%? That's less than are in Congress.
I was so shocked. And I had actually crunched the numbers a few years ago for another article. So this sort of seems to be one of my beats. And at that time, I counted it differently. I just counted the number of acts. So I didn't count every, because, you know, when a band gets inducted, every member of that band gets inducted, including, you know, if they've gone through like 20 members, you know, most of those members will get inducted as well. So when I just counted it, not by each of the, not counting all the members of the bands, it was like 14%, which was still really bad. But when I counted it now, just really counting every individual member, because that's actually a more important measurement in the sense that those members are also the voters, right? So
yeah.
So it's a self-perpetuating system. Fewer than, and you know, and you cannot tell me that fewer than 8% of the important artists of the last 50 years or since World War II, or whatever you want to call the rock era, that fewer than 8% of them have been women.
You make a very good case there, Professor.
And so, and you know, a lot of it is how they're defining rock and roll. So yeah, why is Def Leppard in
Bon Jovi?
Yeah. And Bjork is not. I mean,
and Bjork, or how about Carole King? She's not in there.
No, she's in there as a songwriter. This is like, I mean, it's just so insane. She's in there as a songwriter, Jerry Joffin, not as her own. Tina Turner is in there.
Yeah, Tina Turner
with Ike. In there with Ike, not on her own.
Her own abuser. Right?
It's just vile. Vile, and I make some ideas of things that they could change, but I do worry that the whole institution is just rotten to its core.
Are you a member of the Rock and Roll?
You mean, do I vote?
Yes.
I do vote. Yeah. Okay. You know, and honestly, they only asked me to vote a few years ago. And I'm like, you know, I've been doing this for about 30 years. So thanks for finally asking me. Voter, which I mean, it also just tells you that they're just.
It sounds like you're throwing shade at them, Professor.
I, you know, my account, it's not personal. I mean, I guess it is in the sense that I haven't, you know, I went to the opening. I believed in it in the beginning, even though the first class had no women in them. The very first class of inductees, there were no women. It just, don't get me started.
we destroy the patriarchy one brick at a time.
Yeah. So, I mean, I suggest that they have just all female ballots for a few years to try to even out the numbers, you know, bring it up to at least double digits. Could we have double digits at least percentage?
Yes. Yes, at least 10. Right, right, right. All right, let's discuss your newest book, Women Who Rock, Bessie to Beyonce, Girl Groups to Riot Girl, a celebration of 104 of the most important and influential women in rock and roll history. Now, I believe this is a joint affair that you led with other women writers. Is that correct?
Right, yes. Yeah. So this is a collection of original essays and original illustrations about a century's worth of great musicians, all female identified, and all the writers and all of the illustrators also are women. There's over 30 writers, there's 6 illustrators, and it begins with Bessie Smith, and it goes up to Brittany Howard from Alabama Shakes, and covers a lot of ground in between, a lot of. These are people who are not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but perhaps.
I think we've already established that.
It's maybe an alternative to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That's not what it was created for, but I certainly think it can stand as that. I mean, and certainly, yes, the idea was that there is a history and a lineage and a body of work here that isn't always acknowledged. And that there are shared experiences and stories that can be gleaned and that, you know, you can see the connections between
one artist to the other.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah.
The lines that took the influence of a particular artist back to one in the past. Right.
Right. And then, you know, they're short essays that could easily just, you know, read one a day. But every writer had to feel passionately about the subject that they were writing about. So they're really, you know, persuasive pieces of why these artists matter.
Well, taking our conversation on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and because we have brought up the legendary Joan Jett, I remember it's a campaign. And I watched her campaign closely from, you know, probably around the movie, really kind of gave impetus for her and her manager, co-writer, everything to her, Kenny Laguna, to kind of begin the process of getting the name out there and the need for her inclusion into it. And it is, it's very much like a political campaign in just about anything. And a book like this can certainly help many other potential inductees to make that case.
I hope so.
So how did you narrow down the list to 104?
Right. Yeah. That, you know, that was
definitely an interesting number to begin with. But why that number and how did you get to that?
Right. Yeah. Well, we were trying to keep it below 100 and then, you know,
you obviously failed.
Yeah, we did. I mean, it just became too painful. And there were still so many painful omissions. It's not every woman who rocks. It's 104 that we think, you know, represent a range of eras, genres, life stories. You know, we wanted both those who were well known and some that were not, right? Because I think that's an important part of the story is the way in which women artists can sometimes not be given the careers and the respect that they deserve.
Yeah, which has come up several times in this discussion.
Right. Madonna's in there. There is also Anna Tijoux, who is a Chilean rapper that probably most of your listeners haven't heard of, but who's extremely...
I was just going to say, you got me there. Even I don't know that name.
Yeah, you know, so, but who's, you know, very talented and in Chile is well known and in parts of Latin America. And also trying to expand the concept of what rock is, because I think that, you know, this, like, as we talked about earlier, this notion that it's, you know, defined by guys with guitars, you know, maybe particularly white guys with guitars, that's a very particular notion of the music history of the last 60 years or 100 years.
Well, shouldn't we maybe have a better definition or a different name for it? I mean, to me, hip hop, while a lot of it is being included in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I feel like that's just a co-option by an older art form trying to retain its relevancy. I see hip hop as a completely different art form, and it should be celebrated as such.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that the problem is that, you know, I mean, really, it's all just music, right? And, you know, and the problem is that the history of music in this country is often defined by race and by color. And you had race charts. And sometimes the difference between the musics on the charts is really just about skin color, right?
Yeah.
And you see that right now with the whole thing with, you know, Lil Nas X and the country charts, you know, where Old Town Road gets taken off the country charts.
It's just because he's black, right?
You know, because his name is Lil Nas X.
So you're calling the country charts racist?
Absolutely. And sexist, for sure, you know.
Well, it is the country charts.
Yeah.
You know, it's... Unfortunately, you know, we thought out of the 60s, we were moving towards a more inclusive society.
Right.
And think maybe the last couple of years, the veneer has been ripped off and the underbelly exposed.
Yep.
And this sort of thing, geez, I mean, would you agree that we are kind of at a crossroads here in politics, culture, gender, and music?
I think we could be.
There's only two paths to go, either building that more perfect union or some sort of fantasy old time era that never really existed. That's to me what the choices are.
Right, right. Well, and if you look at, you know,
which is really just about subjugation.
Right. And a return to, yeah, a time that was great for certain people, but not for others.
Yeah. Yeah. Purposefully.
Right.
Which is weird in the concept in and of itself. But I'm not sure that you can actually do that. I hate to use this metaphor again, but putting the genie back in the bottle, I just don't see that being possible. I think a whole lot of people may have to die to prove the point, which has happened many times in history. But there is no going backwards to anything at all in life. There's only forward momentum.
I hope. And I hope it doesn't take a lot of people dying. But, you know, it's like we're fighting the Civil War again, you know? We're on the...
Well, that's because we didn't completely end it in the first place.
Yep.
I think that's part of the problem. Not to delve too much into the racial politics in this country, but, you know, the fact is that, yeah, we had a big civil war. 650,000 people were killed to determine that African-Americans are not slaves and that they deserve a place in this country just like any other land of immigrants does. And then we spent 100 years basically allowing a portion of this country to say no.
Right.
And in the last 60 years, we've tried to say yes.
And now people are saying no again.
Right. So when do we shut those people up? When do they just die? I'm not sure how familiar you are with the concept of the lost cause and why it all came about the way it did. But to allow those people to have a voice of lunacy, of irrationality, whatever the cause is, it's as akin to giving the microphone to the village idiot.
Right.
And I don't understand why we allow that to happen.
Wait, did we just start talking about Kid Rock?
Amongst others. obviously, you're not a fan. So, okay, without delving too far into that. Where do you think we are in 20 years? And we'll musically on top, but let's face it, Professor, you also delve into politics and gender.
Well, I mean, I think that this is somewhat last generational gas. Although, you know, the alt-right gives me worry that a new generation is taking this up. But, you know, I think overall...
If I may, just real quick, my hope is that their voice is just amplified artificially.
Right. That they're a very small minority who is able to get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I think that America is what, you know, it's going to become majority minority still.
There's no stopping that.
We're not going to change the tide of immigration. We're not going to change the tide of intermarriage. You know, kids today are like looking at socialism. Kids today have a very different understanding of climate change. And, you know, feminism is cool among kids today.
Well, kids in the 60s had a lot of great ideals too, but they didn't follow through politically.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I feel like kids today, this is just, they're just grown up. They're just growing up accepting that racism is wrong.
Yeah. And again, let me remind the audience, you are a professor, associate professor at Loyola Marymount. You are dealing with these folks every day.
Right. And, you know,
you have firsthand knowledge.
And, you know, and LMU, you know, it's a Catholic university. So, I mean, we do, I think we're overall progressive, we're Jesuit, you know, which is a particular form of Catholicism. But it's a religious university. So it's not like, I mean, you know, a lot of what's happening with the conservatism in this country is just to be against colleges, to be against universities.
Education in general.
To be against, which is so frightening to me. It's like, oh my gosh, people just want to be serfs again. you know.
There are a certain segment of the population that prefers a black and white world, which we know, if you have any form of education, does not exist. There are mythologies that are put in place to make the world appear that way. And those people tend to gravitate towards those mythologies. You know, let's face it, we're also dealing in an interconnected world, which is radically changing how the world runs, not unlike we did with the Industrial Revolution here 150 years ago. And so, yeah, to your point, those children that are educated are going to live in one world, and those that aren't will not.
Yeah, that really worries me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we're supposed to be moving towards a system where we just go in college and getting more educated. And, you know, that's the way to stamp out having an underclass. Now, I understand that the barons of our universe want an underclass because it's a slave class, right?
Well, I might put it that in all instances, once you begin to educate a sliver or a segment or even a whole of a population, they begin making demands.
Right. Absolutely.
And if you have an uneducated populace, then they just kind of shrug their shoulders, put their head down and go, I guess it's just the way it is.
Right.
And education doesn't necessarily have to come from a well-known system today. I mean, you know, what I do see, and to take this in a more positive direction, because I think we both dove off the cliff here,
is that
these kids are walking around with the entire encyclopedia of human knowledge in their hands, regardless of your official or
right.
education.
Right, right. Except we also know now how easily a lot of that
is. It is to be manipulated.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. And also information is not the same thing as knowledge, or not the same thing as wisdom.
Yes.
And that's sometimes what people are not getting.
Will that affect the music for the next generation?
Well, I do worry about there not being the sort of splinterization.
The fragmentation,
the loss of water cooler culture of shared conversations, and that we're all in our little silos and we find our little affinity groups online and we're not all listening to the same top 40.
Well, we don't live in a monoculture anymore.
We don't. So, I mean, and so that's a good thing.
And we live in a global environment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like most things, it's a double-edged sword. There is good and bad in all. You know, you hope that we progress with forward momentum, but as a student of history, that's not always the case.
Right. And I don't know that I want the monoculture of the king of pop.
Right.
Right. You know, to go back to the start of this conversation, you know, I don't know that we want that kind of over idolatrization. Maybe we can have multiple streams that become popular. I just hope that we're listening to each other's music, you know, and then that's why it disturbs me when I see that the top downloading artists of 2018 are almost all male.
Yeah.
Because that's ultimately what it has to come down to. You have to listen, you have to want to pay attention to a culture that is not yours, that or an identity that is not yours.
You know? Well, that starts with a curious mind, and not everybody is born with that or has that instilled in them from their parents.
Right.
You know, to your point, you know, yeah, sampling is great. And I don't mean the technology of sampling. I mean the actual go out and sample. You know, the choices are there. It is available, and it's easier to achieve today than ever before. People just need to engage.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I don't want to end this on a bummer. So let's talk about one last conversation about another one of your books, Mama Rama, the memoir of sex, kids, and rock and roll. And I understand you are a rock and roll mother.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess. I mean, just by nature, because I'm a rock and roll everything, I am not one of those moms who is like trying to make my son listen to my music.
Like the Beatles or the Michael Jackson.
At a younger age, that worked, maybe.
How old are your kids?
Started out. So my stepdaughters are in their 20s. The older one is almost 30. And my son is 16.
Well, he's right in the middle of determining his music. Right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, and the worst thing I can do is like recommend something to him.
Otherwise, you're going to get all Swedish death metal.
I mean, you know, it's pretty much all like SoundCloud hip hop right now. You know, he's definitely like choosing the music that's going to push my buttons lyrically, because I'm pretty open to musical styles. But lyrically, he's definitely trying to.
Yeah, there's not a lot of subtlety in most hip hop lyrics these days.
Yeah. And, you know, we actually have interesting conversations around Extentacion,
Extension, yes.
Extension, yeah. I would say wrong, but who, you know, he loves and actually whose music I think is actually really, really great.
This was the kid that was assassinated. Right?
Yeah. Who was shot. Yeah. But, yeah. You know, who also was, you know, arrested for like punching his pregnant girlfriend in the stomach, you know, so yeah. Very complicated.
Not the greatest role model.
No, but, you know, but the music is actually really, really good and very complex. And I think he's probably, you know, I think cancellation culture has maybe overly written him out. And there's a generational gap there. So, you know, I do try to listen to some of what he listens to, I really like, but the attitudes towards women are like the worst. They're just the worst. It's like,
very misogynistic. Yes.
Yeah, no, it's horrible. It's horrible objectification.
Well, I have a 19-year-old who goes to a Catholic university as well, University of Portland. And we went through that, and let's say he's mellowed with age.
Good. I know it's a phase, and I know that if I push back, it's just going to make it worse. So
yeah, Swedish death metal, I'm telling you. So.
But, you know, we do every now and then try to appreciate each other's music.
So being a Mama Rama is not an easy job.
No. No, and you know, and because you know, mothers like represent the thing that we rebel against, right? And they represent the person who tells you no, And I don't want to be the person who says no. Like, that I'm, you know, the kind of feminism that I embrace is, you know, what they call pro-pleasure feminism, right? It's the feminism of saying yes. Mm. But as a mom, you got to say no.
Right. Yes.
It's a contradiction.
There's a dichotomy going on there. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, all right. So what's next for you, Evelyn?
I'm editing a series of books called the Music Matters series, which are short books on single artists, kind of deep dives into favorite subjects. And so it's, you know, why the Ramones matter, why the Beach Boys matter, why Karen Carpenter matters, why Rage Against the Machine matters. And it's for University of Texas Press. So I'm basically doing A&R for them. I'm finding titles and writers and bringing them to the series. So that's sort of my alternative Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Oh, you're making the alternative Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Okay.
There's a few alternative Rock and Roll Hall
of Fame. You hear that, Jan Warner? You got competition.
So I'm editing that series. And I think the next thing, I'm going to write a book, not edit a book. But I haven't decided. Maybe it's going to be one of these books. I haven't decided yet.
All right. All right. Well, Evelyn McDonald, thank you so much for being on Deeper Digs in Rock today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really, really fun.
Let's hear it for Professor McDonald. I'm so glad we are able to expand the rock and roll canon. Her work is essential. In fact, what we are trying to do around here is, you know, kind of a bachelor's course, but people like Evelyn are really the master's class. Please go out and read all of her books. And if you are really up to it, keep an eye on the professor for higher education. Best place would be to check out the faculty page at Loyola Marymount University. And that leads me to the takeaway this week. That is our love of talking to these academics that elevate this music that we all love to the art form it should be considered in. It is high art because it is a record of the times. It affected the culture and vice versa for a very long time, for 50 years at least. It went global. The further we get away from the actual age of rock and roll, the latter half of the 20th century, we'll be informing academics for generations who will be trying to understand the full story. People like Professor McDonald or Professor Yaffe or Professor Hughes, who we've also had time to talk with, are important figures in this quest. I, for one, can't wait to dig deeper with other academics in the near future, and I hope you all agree. Okay, until next week, where we will hear from a real legend in the rock and roll story. Danny Goldberg will be joining us, a man that could fill up several episodes with his history in music. But we will mostly focus on his current book, Serving the Servant, Remembering Kurt Cobain, where Danny puts pen to paper on his experiencing managing Nirvana just before their rise to superstardom and until the horrible tragedy of Cobain's death. You'll want to come back for that. Hey, everybody. Remember, keep up the rockin'.
I'll make you feel like you Looking for ways to help right the wrongs of social injustice? Oxfam America works with people in more than 90 countries to save lives, develop long-term solutions to poverty, and campaign for social change. And we do it with the help of our friends in the music world. The Beatles were Oxfam supporters back in the day. So were the Stones. And through the years, musicians and music fans have helped Oxfam push hard to work for a just world without poverty. Folks like Radiohead, Coldplay, Pearl Jam, DJ Shadow, and many, many more have encouraged their fans to join the effort. You can too. Go to OxfamAmerica.org to learn how you can help.
Deeper Digs in Rock, produced and hosted by Kristen Swain. All sound design and incidental music by Busy Signal Studios. Find all of our shows, notes, social, and links at www.pantheonpodcast.com or wherever you listen to great podcasts. All songs can be found for purchase on iTunes, Spotify, or Google Play. Please purchase these great and important tracks. Find us on Facebook at The RNRAP. We are on Instagram at RNR Archaeology. Tweet us at RNR Archaeology.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.